Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is a recorded edition of Bathrobes, Spears, Broadsides, normally from 6 to 8 every Thursday evening. And you can catch us off air at 423-4833. But listen to this recorded show and enjoy. This is an interview with Elisa de la Peña of the Coalition on Homelessness's Civil Rights Project, recorded about 3 weeks ago.
Sound like they're really focused on providing help for homeless people.
They are very big about talking about it. For instance, a measure that I guess didn't pass in the last election, Proposition U, they spent a lot of time, many, many hours, putting it on the ballot. It would provide $600,000, a 2% increase in the transient occupancy tax to pay for a family shelter, which would have housed, I don't know, what, 20 more families? 25 more families. And that's good, but they could have done that at any time out of the general fund. And they have essentially uniformly avoided an expansion of shelter, except now during this election it becomes an issue they want to discuss. And they also wanted to avoid the issue of the sleeping ban, which was a hot potato this summer. There was a lot of pressure. There were fasts, protests, mass sit-ins, sleep-ins, shout-ins, you name it.
Yeah.
To get this sleeping ban measure either passed by the city council, the repeal of it, or put on the ballot.
Right.
And they refused to do either. Instead, they put this Proposition U, which is the, you know, this shelter for 20 or 25 families on the ballot instead, and it failed.
We awarded a pie to the most anti-homeless council member, too.
You awarded a what?
We gave a special pie to the... We announced we were going to present, they have a special pie in the pusser presentation. And that man was council member Rotkin, who declined the honor, so we had to have a stand-in get pied in his place.
That sounds like a good event.
It was a fun event. Even the critics laughed there, because I was the guy that got pied. So.
And I got to pie him.
She got to pie me, man. So it was a lot of fun, but then when we tried to bring a porta potty into the city council chambers, not a big one, but a little kind of commode you have by the side of a bed.
With spray painted gold and had ribbons on it.
Spray painted gold and called the Golden Potty Award to present it to the council because city council refused to provide porta potties and dumpsters in the areas that they were talking about opening up as safe sleeping zones. So the council then used the pretext that the homeless were taking a crap in the bushes as the basis for not saying they're dirty and they won't be able to use those safe sleeping zones. So we gave them we tried to give them this Golden Porta Potty Award. I was told if I brought it into the city council chambers, I would be arrested.
Wow.
So they're a pretty sensitive bunch here in Santa Cruz. They try to keep run a firm ship.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Well, we've covered a lot of some of the questions that I was going to ask, just in talking generally about what's going on there.
We should talk about this.
Well, I think you got a number of them. I can run through some more if you want, or you can ask some more, whichever you'd like.
We could do it either way. Have you talked about, are there other anti-homeless ordinances that, or laws that are used, enforced discriminatorily against homeless people?
Open container laws, drunk in public, are very often enforced against homeless people almost exclusively. Sitting on the sidewalk seems to be enforced differentially against either young people, poor people, or people of color.
Santa Cruz was the first city in California to pass sit on the sidewalk, go to jail laws under the mayorship of Resource Center for Nonviolence, guided by Gandhi Mayor Scott Kennedy, who unfortunately has won re-election.
I heard that this morning.
Very sad news for a lot of us. There's also such things as the park closing laws.
Wait, the panhandling law, too? Okay, go ahead.
There's such things as the park closing law, which makes it illegal to be in the parks after dark. You have that in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And there's a law which criminalizes even walking up and down the riverbank after dusk.
Wow.
Which was passed by this so-called progressive council majority in the last couple of years. They have the youth curfew laws, of course, theoretically impact the homeless because you can't tell a homeless youth to go home. However, there haven't been many reports of the youth curfew being enforced. And Becky, you were saying about other laws, panhandling law.
We have a very strict panhandling law. It's illegal to panhandle in groups of two. It's illegal to panhandle from a sitting position.
Wow.
It's illegal to panhandle after dark. You can't be within 50 feet of an ATM machine. Is there something about doorways too, Robert?
Oh yeah, you have to be 10 or 15 feet from a doorway, a certain number of feet from a crosswalk. It's also illegal to lie about what you're doing with the money.
Oh my gosh.
And it theoretically is legal to sit down even at night with a sign, even in a group of two, that says, "I want money," but if you don't say anything, if you make no utterance, in other words, shut up and lay low, or as I used to say about Mike Rotkin, his solution to the sleeping situation, hide out or get out is his approach.
You can't lie down anywhere downtown.
At all, ever.
Night or day.
What I was saying, though, was that if you have a sign, it's legal to just hold up a sign. However, even though it's legal, police officers and hosts have repeatedly harassed people for doing so, told them they'll get tickets. A 67-year-old man who was panhandling for money to go visit his wife on the East Coast, he does this regularly, he takes the bus. His wife is in a hospital in I guess North Carolina. The local community service officer came by and told him he had to stand with his sign silently, when in fact he could sit with it. I mean, just sort of really cruel stuff.
Wow.
And these police officers and CSOs are not disciplined, as far as I know, for this kind of anti-homeless treatment. And I'm not saying that they are worse than San Francisco cops, because, you know, I don't know. But you have a situation where homeless complaints to the Citizens Police Review Board, which is a joke in itself,
right,
are routinely dismissed, where the anti-homeless officer, Rick Seeley, has actually gotten a special funded position as a liaison police officer in the only recommendation to be accepted from more than 36 recommendations on the Homeless Issues Task Force, which is a $10,000 task force that met for nearly a year. Another sop to the community that the city council gave us when they failed to take any action to end the sleeping ban in the winter of 1998-99. We have a lot of sort of gestures that are actually used to crank up anti-homeless laws, you know, like, as I say, expedited police enforcement.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about sweeps.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have a large area near Santa Cruz of open space called the Pogonip. P-O-G-O-N-I-P.
P-O-N-I-P.
P-O-G-O-N-I-P.
Okay.
Pogonip.
Pogonip.
Yeah, and in, I think it was in September, we heard of the big sweep going with Parks and Recs going through, allegedly because of fire hazards in there. But
right.
A lot of people,
there's always a reason.
A lot of people said they thought it was because the election was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So, we heard a lot of people who were displaced or lost their gear or, had problems that way by Parks and Rec. Another sweep that happened, this is 2 years ago, we have the first night event on, January 1st,
mm-hmm.
December 31st, January 1st, and about 3 or 4 days before first night, the police kind of camped at the corner of Highway 1 and Highway 9, which is the crosswalk where homeless people come from the Homeless Services Center walking to town or back,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very busy intersection, a very dangerous intersection, and the crosswalks are timed, so you don't have a lot of time to get across that intersection.
Right.
And they were citing people left and right for not getting across the intersection fast enough. I mean, they even cited a guy who had like a walker. And, you know, he could only walk so fast across the intersection, so he got cited for not going across. It seemed a very obvious sweep to us to prevent people from going down to the first night event.
Another example of harassment of the homeless is in order to get directly to one of the two all-night restaurants in town where you can go to get a cup of coffee and get in and out of the rain, mm-hmm. when you're avoiding the sleep patrols, if you will,
right.
or just trying to get warm, exactly. is Denny's, which is right at the edge of Ocean Street. And the most direct route is to go across a freeway bridge where there's freeway traffic and sort of a narrow lip you can walk on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that perilous, though people have been hit there. But homeless people are regularly cited for doing that, and they've made no attempt, let's say, to establish a pedestrian bridge or to establish an extra lane so people can walk. Well, and if you don't go across that bridge, you have to walk literally, what, a mile and a half, 2 miles around, something like that.
Over a mile.
So there's that. Also, there's
a $182 ticket for using the Highway 1 overpass to walk across.
There's an ordinance for making it illegal to have a dog, even on a leash, on the mall downtown. And this law is regularly enforced differentially against homeless and counterculture-looking people.
Oh, tell her about the marijuana bus. And
you can tell her.
There's been a pattern of sighting, usually homeless or youth, a lot of the youth, young people, they'll have possession of a very small amount of marijuana, and they cite them for a more serious crime of possession with intent to sell.
Huh.
And so they're getting like felony charges against these kids.
Wow.
Now when they go to court, usually they don't throw them in jail, but what they'll do is they'll get a stay away order from the downtown.
Right.
So we're seeing that as kind of like a practice of banishment from the downtown area using these pumped up drug law crimes.
There's also a failure to allow people, let's say, to display their merchandise, like some people make their own crafts and need a place to do so,
mm-hmm.
and they display it for donations and get money for it. They do so up and down Pacific Avenue on occasion, and it kind of varies with the sergeant in charge as to how heavy the repression is, but last sergeant on the mall, Sergeant Hennig, would walk up to such people and say, "I'm giving all this away. This is all being given away. Give it to people passing by." He would actually pick up people's wares and give it to them. The people naturally would give it back to the merchants, but it was an example of the kind of attitude that poor people, homeless people, transients, counterculture people face downtown on Pacific Avenue.
Wow.
There aren't any new laws being considered. Well, I mean, there's always sort of little things happening, like the new parking lots are being built with anti-homeless design factors that make it, for example, difficult to sleep in a vehicle because the whole thing is slanted, the floor is slanted, and written into the specifications of the building are to make sure that there are no places where people can loiter.
Wow.
And I've spoken about that in opposing more money for parking lots in that regard. You can see the anti-homeless priorities and the huge amount of money that goes into the police station, which I think it was $6 million originally to build a new police station, and had a $7 million cost overrun. And in terms of social services, you know, this thing on the ballot would have been $600,000 a year in taxes additional for a small family shelter. The council has refused to even discuss a campground. They closed the last homeless campground in 1995 at Christmas. As a consequence, numerous people died, both of drug overdoses and other things. Though when the campground was actually operational, though there was constant complaints about the fact everybody was crammed in and that it was, you know, there was drugs and alcohol and dogs and things of that sort, and misconduct of all sorts. And some of it, you know, not too pleasant because you had different communities there.
Right.
You didn't have any deaths because it was right adjacent to the homeless services center, and the one time that there was an overdose, it was dealt with. When these people dispersed, they began to die. And you had numerous homeless activist Dan Hopkins blames the city council for many deaths in 1997. And there's been no reopening of a homeless campground. And, of course, the rents, as you know, Santa Cruz is just as bad as San Francisco, although I haven't studied your situation.
Homeless deaths was another question you'd asked about here. It's very hard to get statistics on. Even this whole homeless census thing didn't ask about the death rate of homeless people, which I found surprising.
Yeah.
We personally counted 18 homeless deaths in 1999.
Wow.
In the city of Santa Fe.
There's a 19th, too, I think.
A 19?
Yeah, there were 19 total. And that's just the city. The county, when we try to get stats, the sheriff's office and the coroner's office haven't given them to us. We've requested them repeatedly from the Board of Supervisors. We also have requested from the police chief stats on beatings of homeless people. It took many, many months, actually years, to get Chief Steve Belcher to release the stats for 1 year on beatings of homeless people in 1999. We found beatings were 4 to 10 times more frequent of people who were homeless than people who were in houses.
It was actually documented. 51 cases of assault or battery where a homeless person was a victim.
Uh-huh.
51 cases in 1999.
Out of a total
reported.
Out of a total of 550 assaults. Total, and you're talking about a population of about 55,000 people. No, actually, within the city, it's a population of, how many people do we have in Santa Cruz, the city?
54,000.
Right, 54,000, that's right. So you can do the math yourself, and you could also...
There's some more here, too.
And you have a homeless population of anywhere between, well, we estimated at 500 to 1,500 at that time. Now we realize with the census it's 1,000 to 2,000.
Elisa?
Percentage, yeah.
Okay, the homeless, the survey that was done of the 800 homeless people, they asked if they had been a victim of a crime,
mm-hmm.
And 72 said they were physically beaten.
Wow.
13 said they were sexually assaulted, and 5 people said they were victims of police abuse.
How many victims of police abuse?
5.
Okay.
Wow.
We get much larger figures when we talk to people.
Yeah, and that's not including people robbed or victimized by the system was another. Physically beaten, sexually assaulted, and police abuse. That's 2, 3, 5. That's 90 people out of 811. In 1 year time.
Those figures are very low, too. We found that...
Well, these are probably more accurate than the ones that were reported to the police. Then they said, if you were a victim of crime, did you contact law enforcement representative about this crime? And 90 said that they had, but 119 said they hadn't. So that's 56.9%. Even though they were a victim of a crime, did not file a report.
Probably felt like they would be ignored in some cases.
People, they're really worried. They feel like that the repercussions if they file a police report or a complaint at the Citizens Police Review Board, people are very fearful of doing that, and they generally don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had people in San Francisco who have filed complaints who have then been targeted for enforcement or harassment of other laws.
Yeah, we had that we had that 2 years ago, and they were having these token hearings where the city council would go to the homeless services center and meet with homeless people, and the man who filed the first complaint against assault was later given a ticket ticketed for open container in the mail. For a prior incident.
Wow.
That's kind of interesting. Also, the 4 to 10 rate of homeless beatings, more than those in houses that I gave you. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That is of reported beatings. But
That's reported.
We only think that like 1 out of 10 is reported, so it's probably higher by a significant factor.
Yeah.
At least we had found that. We wrote several articles on the issue of homeless beatings before Belcher issued his report. We've also requested from Belcher a list of arrests and convictions. He hasn't done that. We've also requested stats going back through the years so we can see if there's been an increase in homeless beatings, and the police chief of the city has refused to do that as well. Also, the police have refused so far to take anti-racial profiling measures that say, you know, indicate the racial makeup of a person in a police stop.
Right.
We've asked if they include the economic makeup, if the person appears homeless or as a counterculture person, so we can get some indication whether police are stopping these people differentially more frequently.
They won't.
Their response is to the Citizens Police Review Board, which sort of fluffs them right along. Their response is, we don't have the software. But they claim they're going to do it in the next year at some point in terms of racial profiling, because of the pressure statewide.
Yeah.
In that regard.
Of the people that they counted at the March 21st point in time count, 30% were living in their cars.
Okay. 30% of the 811.
No, the 811 is the survey. This is the point in time count.
Oh, sorry. Right, 1,200.
Well, I gave you the 1,200 and, what was it, 73? Number, but, the survey was done countywide, so it does have some breakdown citywide, but I don't have an exact breakdown for how many homeless were in the city, so you can presume that the 1,273, 30% were in vehicles.
Okay.
And there are a lot of laws that impact homeless people, as you know, which aren't local, but that have the same kind of impact, have to do with insurance for vehicles, registration fees, things of that sort, which affect poor people because they can't afford to keep what they have.
Right.
And to keep things rolling. Driving without a license, if you can't afford to pay the licensing fees.
Right.
Business improvement districts, I believe we have violations of the Brown Act or Open Meetings Act by the, not just by the city council when it meets behind closed doors and is currently involved in a scheme to evict a great number of Hispanic tenants in the beach flats and make them homeless in the name of affordable housing. They'll be building an affordable housing project which only some of them will be able to return to. And they will not provide for the rest of them that are forced to leave. That's a struggle we've been fighting, and most of this has been worked out in closed session of city council. But we also have the Downtown Association, which receives funding from the city, holding meetings that are closed to the public. And it's groups like the Downtown Association that gave us originally the downtown ordinances. That I've mentioned them to you before: sit on the sidewalk, go to jail, ask for a dime after dark, go to jail. There's also laws against, these were all passed in 1994 in the wake of the roulette decision in Seattle.
Right.
And there's also the fact that other laws that were passed at the same time were things like set up a table near a sidewalk cafe is illegal. It was a deliberate swat at homeless people who were doing anti-sleeping ban tables near cafes, particularly the one cafe owner in town who was on the city council, Neil Coonerty, who owns the bookshop Santa Cruz. There was also, it became an onerous process for having a parade or a so-called non-commercial event was put into effect. It became illegal to even to set up a voter registration table in front of a cafe.
Wow.
It became illegal to perform music in front of a cafe. And, of course, people do these things all the time. It's just, it gives the cafe owner the power to remove someone in this further privatization of public space when they don't like what they're doing.
Right.
And that, in essence, is what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, skipping down to your question about what does your city do you have for homeless people with substance abuse or mental health issues? On the substance abuse level, for drug and alcohol treatment, the only program that's available to homeless people is Janus. And Janus typically has 2 slots at any given time for homeless people.
Wow.
It has, you know, more beds than that, but, you know, only about 2. So it's just grossly negligent in terms of the need that's out there.
Wow.
You could probably talk about the mental health issues, Robert.
Mm-hmm. But first I want to mention that the sweeps, you ask whether they're connected to athletic events or political events. Yeah, they have these events where the Pacific Garden Mall, once the Pacific Garden Mall, now the Pacific Concrete Mall,
is
closed.
Okay.
Becky is taking
Bye-bye,
off.
Lisa.
Becky's taking off.
Thank you so much, Becky.
They close it and they sweep the area for people that they consider intoxicated who are not middle class looking. If you're a middle class teenager and you're going to college, that's fine. If you're a homeless person who's been around for 40 years, then you're an eyesore. Robert Steffen, the man in the bag that I mentioned to you,
mm-hmm.
was incarcerated twice in a psych ward on the eve of a cultural fair and some other public event that closed off the mall because the city wanted him and the merchants wanted him removed during these events. And they as a pretext, and in essence they did a false arrest, a detention under a 5150, which I guess is not, it's an arrest I guess, but the section of the Welfare and Institutions Code that mandates, you know, being incarcerated in a psych ward.
Right, right. And that was two separate occasions?
Let me be more accurate. There was one occasion where there was a second occasion. He has been the target of injunctions. That's another tool that is used by the local police / judicial establishment / merchants in collusion, I would say, at least through the collusion of silence with the city council. They, as Becky's already mentioned, they use stay-away orders from the mall as part of any kind of criminal proceeding to keep people out of the downtown that they just don't want there, that may not have too much to do with what they did. You know, if it's a drug piece of behavior, they keep people away from an area, but why wouldn't they just do the drug behavior somewhere else? I mean, you know, it becomes a tool of opportunity to remove them from an area of the downtown.
Right.
Steffen was taken definitely once during an event because it seemed clear they removed him on Friday and they returned him on Monday and the ward said there was nothing wrong with him, or I guess they removed him on Saturday and they returned him on Sunday, and it was a one day event or a 1.5 day event or something.
Uh-huh.
And they've used an injunction against him to remove him from a bench in front of one of the merchant's stores. He traditionally would come to this bench, sit there in a bag all day with a sign and a little carriage that said running for president 2000, and would list his campaign. And he would talk about his campaign. He was wrapped up in his sack. And the merchants proclaimed they had great concern about his health and his mental health and all this stuff. And perhaps they persuaded themselves they did, but I didn't think that was really their main motivation.
Right.
They accused him, after their employees would come out and spit on him, they accused him of staring through the window at the women who worked at Bunny's Shoes.
Oh, my God.
I mean, we took this to court. The judge allowed this injunction to go on for a couple of months. Finally, when it came to court, he dissolved the temporary restraining order. But when this man called the police because he had his sign stolen, he was himself accused of disturbing the peace because he shouted, "You stop thief." And he was... as a condition of this, he was on probation, I remind you, for trespass, for sleeping at the homeless services center.
Oh, right.
He was, and as a condition of his, he said they would violate his probation unless he agreed to move on from that bench. They devoted, I would say, tens of thousands of dollars to get him to move from this bench in front of Bunny's Shoes near the Palomar Hotel on downtown Pacific Avenue.
Wow.
In Santa Cruz. And he moved to the Bookshop Santa Cruz bench, where he's been ever since. And in fact, some wit this Halloween sat down in a bag on the bunny's bench in order to give the bunny's people heart attacks. And I don't know what happened there, but it certainly would have been poetic justice if some of them had gotten heart attacks. Unfortunately, as far as bringing litigation, I mentioned to you that Judge Tom Kelly essentially said the law was constitutional. We've at different times challenged the law at lower levels and gotten nowhere. Homeless people, as you know, are a difficult group to do a sustained challenge for, because
mm-hmm.
they leave town, and it's also hard to find legal resources. So if you decide you want to come down here and help us, please do. We've talked to Adam at different times up there, and
mm-hmm.
Judy was not terribly helpful, although I'm sure she was very well intended, because you guys have your own problems you have to take care of up there, I know.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a real opening for a legal attorney, a legal eagle, to come down and do some challenging of the sleeping ban, given the huge disparity between shelter and people, and the fact that there are no legal places to sleep, and obviously this ridiculous notion that if you sleep during the day, that's some sort of solution. It's no solution, obviously, for working homeless people. It's no solution whatsoever. And it obviously unfairly burdens people. And I would imagine violates other basic constitutional protections as well.
Yeah.
The ACLU has been notoriously reticent to get involved in any of this. They've taken some technical issues around the city council's attempt to regulate the size of signs that homeless people used in protests in 1996 around the city council sleepers vigil, as we called it, or sleepers protest.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the right to sleep at night, you know, there's a class line here that I think that the ACLU locally has not been willing to cross, or maybe it's a political line. It's too hot a potato among the local political establishment for them to say, you know, homeless people have a right to sleep, dump this stupid sleeping ban law.
Right.
But there has been political, you know, kind of potential progress. Most of the candidates who are running, unfortunately, got two who won who are against any changes in the sleeping ban, one of whom blames protesters for there being a sleeping ban, sort of like saying, all our good niggers, you know, don't need them outside agitators, you know, that sort of thing. The other one, as I said, is the mayor, former Mayor Scott Kennedy, who once claimed to oppose the sleeping ban, but now favors it because, of course, he's become an ally of businesses and redevelopers and is a sort of a typical example of a person who went on the left who went right in the most obvious way, so much so that he was repudiated by the electorate 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But he's back again. Police sensitivity trainings, not that I know of. We tried to get the police department, the council, to consider some changes in the police department, include homeless input into how they deal with the police, in terms of how they interact with homeless people, in terms of their understanding of the laws. We even tried to get some of the Atlanta, Georgia, and Miami, Florida, I guess, consent decree provisions that talked about stopping the police from accosting homeless people unless they had actually reasonable suspicion that a real crime was being committed and not a so-called life-sustaining misdemeanor.
Right, right.
And that hasn't gone anywhere yet. Public education, yes, there have been two initiatives to end the sleeping ban that have gotten thousands of signatures at the city level from registered voters, not just from sort of well-wishers wandering through town.
Right.
People who live here, property owners. But the city council, people at the center of the political establishment are generally so weak-kneed, or I think it's weak-kneed rather than bigoted. I think they listen to the council of people who are afraid of the bigots, not people who are necessarily bigoted themselves.
Right.
And what they've done is they've refused to carry through on any attempt, let's say, to strike the sleeping ban. They talked about safe sleeping zones. That's what the sleeping ban initiative that we presented actually was an attempt to say you can no longer give a ticket to someone for sleeping at all, period.
Right.
But you can tell a person who's sleeping in a particular area of the city, a residential, beachfront, and then later on in the second initiative, downtown, that they will have to move to an industrial or a commercial area, or they will get cited for not moving.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of sort of finessing the sleeping issue. What the city council did was they set up very minuscule industrial zones, passed a first reading, declined to put in the porta-potties and dumpsters that might have done something.
Right.
Allowed the police to misinform everybody and drive them into those zones, and then the police misinformed businesses in those areas that they couldn't enforce ordinary laws, let's say, against drug use or other things, which essentially the police wanted to keep the current laws, so they created a lawless situation there, where they alarmed the merchantry.
Right.
Merchants trooped to city council ranting and raving.
Right.
And the city council just didn't do a second reading, which would have been required to pass this and make it a permanent thing.
Right.
And they've ducked it for the rest of the year. And then shortly thereafter, they refused to put it on the ballot, breaking their promises to the homeless activists who've been protesting for the last year to get it on the November ballot. But that was a successful grassroots organizing campaign. There was a fast all year from January to April. There was organizing and protests, chalk-ins, and as I told you, pie-ins, and sit-ins, and sleep-ins. So, successful in a certain sense. Not successful in that we've gotten the legal changes, but almost every council candidate, and there were 15 for four positions in this last city council election, came out for some sort of either increased shelter or safe sleeping zones. And safe sleeping zones became the watchword, unfortunately, the watchword for evading the issue, because the obvious issue is, if you favor a safe sleeping zone, where?
Right.
You can talk safe sleeping zones all you want, but if you aren't willing to introduce a specific proposal, then it doesn't mean anything. And we got no response, although we interviewed, I think, 12 of the 15 candidates before our homeless working group.
Yeah.
And so we were able to get specific statements from people. In essence, they gave us one statement, then when it came to public discussion at larger forums, they backed away.
Right.
Most of them, the ones who won, kind of backed away. The drug war has also been an issue, as I've not just using the particular felony charges to drive away young people for selling small amounts of marijuana. Mm-hmm. They put cameras up and down the mall. You're now on television when you go down Pacific Avenue.
Wow.
Those are supposed to be public streets. Well, let's say there are at least three locations where homeless people and transient people hang out. One of them is New Leaf Market at Lincoln and Pacific, if you ever come to Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And this is intended to deter, they claim, to deter drug traffic. But, of course, it's also intended to deter people gathering and exercising their First Amendment rights. Other laws that are used, we're going to actually meet one of those laws probably in 3 days. We're having a memorial for Happy John Dine, who is a homeless man he's actually a homeless activist who wasn't homeless when he was killed, but had been. He was sort of developmentally disabled. He was shot in the chest by police for allegedly brandishing a toy gun. And this was back in 1997. However, every non-police witness, and there were more than 10, said he wasn't in a combat stance, he had nothing in his hand, and he wasn't threatening the police.
Wow.
However, they found a toy gun near him, and they used that as the basis to avoid an independent investigation, to sew up the case within 3 hours. The police chief declared the officer innocent. Within 12 hours, the district attorney declared there was no problem, and it's pretty much, that was the Happy John Dine case, and that was November 12th, he was killed. We're having a memorial, and on that day, we will be assembling downtown on Pacific Avenue near the old Del Mar Theater, which, as some theaters has a marquee that extends out over the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been told in the past that the Del Mar owns the area under the sidewalk where its marquee extends. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we cannot set up a table there. Or we cannot go in out of the rain there if it starts to rain.
Wow.
And we expect rain, so we expect to be told when we set up a table and do a little protest there, a little memorial service, actually, that is illegal, and we may take a stand on that and challenge it and see what happens. But again, the challenges are only taken by public defenders who don't have the time and don't have much initiative on this issue, though some consider them very valiant and heroic considering the caseloads they have. I don't really have too much sympathy with public defenders who talk about their caseloads. For me, they should just resign if they feel like they can't do a good job and defend the people that they're supposed to defend.
Right.
I don't want to hear any shit about, I have so many people to defend, even if it's sincere.
Right.
They should quit their job and go do something else.
Right.
You know, and they don't want to do that. Instead, they use it as a pretext to treat ordinary people like they're dirt and like they haven't got time for them. Your standard attorney nonsense, which I'm sure you've seen repeatedly.
Way too much of.
Yep. I mean, I've seen it at the Coalition on Homelessness with attorneys who've been working there, and it's depressed me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's too bad, particularly when it happens there, and it's too bad when it happens down here. We've had one attorney who kind of tries to take a lot of pro bono cases, but she can't keep up with them. Mm-hmm. Her name is Kate Wells. She's currently taking a chalking case. That's another example of homeless people harassed. People chalking in the sleeping van and erasable chalk on the sidewalk are being arrested for writing that.
Wow.
Arrested? Well, they were told he was cited 3 times in a day, and he said he was going to keep on doing it, so he was arrested the 3rd time.
Wow.
Now, the defense thinks that's going to make it difficult to defend him because they now can charge him with obstructing an officer, a different charge. And, of course, this is all loaded stuff, which is simply the police's way of saying, do what we tell you or else you'll go to jail and you'll lose any cases, even if you're right.
Exactly.
And it's particularly hard for homeless people. And it's hard for homeless people in Santa Cruz because there's this I think there's a fear that people are going to be homeless. There's an incredible push to have to work two jobs, so you have to, you haven't got time to stop and even look at what's going on, much less protest and support people who are doing this kind of attempt to change the laws. And some of us have tried to do some sort of Gandhi-esque civil disobedience movement stuff around Santa Cruz, or civil resistance, trying to change the sleeping ban with mass sleepouts and so forth. The IWW, the Wobblies, came to town in 1994 and slept on the streets of Santa Cruz for 2 days, and the police ignored them, and then the third day or the second day, when there was only a few of us left, they came and arrested everybody first. So the police have adopted a differential creative approach. They don't always arrest you. They may ignore you, and then they'll when it's convenient, they'll move in and try to do that. Violence and hate crime, oh yeah, lots of it. I've mentioned those beatings.
Right.
What's the city spending to arrest, cite, or harass homeless people compared to providing emergency shelter? Very good question. I don't have any specific stats. We did an estimate like 12 years ago when they were ticketing homeless people much more frequently for sleeping than they are now. And if we just considered the sleeping, I think we found they spent like $500,000 to $1 million a year, which, though the city council old-timers like to boast that Santa Cruz spends more per capita or as much per capita as any city, this is not true. In a study done by Mayor Celia Scott in 1997, one of the few liberal mayors who actually opposed the sleeping ban and opposed closing off the riverfront and opposed the youth curfew, she was like one out of seven.
Wow.
Who did. She found that there was no... That Santa Cruz is actually toward the bottom of the social spending. She didn't do the kind of comparison you're looking for in terms of costs of enforcement. They've actually funded a whole team of these cheery, grinning, I guess they're wearing purple now. They used to wear green. We used to call them the green-garbed grinners. They were the hosts. They're called the guides in Santa Barbara, and I think they're called the hospitality squad elsewhere. And here, too, actually. They're little kind of para-police groups are supposed to run around and tell people not to sit on the sidewalk and,
right,
you know, not to ask for spare change and not to lie down and not to walk their dog unless they look middle class and that's
right.
So that a lot of money was expended on the hospitality squad, but not on, I mean, you can't go in there and use the phone if you're a homeless person, let's say. Well, they have a phone there and the cops like to hang out in this place. They can't give you any place to sleep most of the time, and I think there are some exceptions. And it's not that the hosts, people who work for them, aren't potentially compassionate people. I mean, you know, the concentration camp guards at Auschwitz, I'm sure, were potentially compassionate people. They were probably very nice to their wives, and they were just doing a job and that sort of thing.
Right.
But of course, it's the institutional restrictions on the job, and I'm not saying that the hosts are exterminating homeless people, although when you begin this kind of differential treatment of people, you know, who knows where it ends.
Yeah.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is a recorded edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides on Thanksgiving. Call 423-4833 if you'd like to make any comments or have anything broadcast on the next edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, which happens Sunday from 11 to 1:30. This is an interview between Elise de la Peña and San Francisco, and myself and Becky Johnson here in Santa Cruz on the issue of anti-homeless laws. In terms of long-term solutions to homelessness, they have a few of their pet projects. They have this community house project, which they built on the bones and ruins of the campground. Campground that served 100 to 200 people. Hang on a second. In terms of long-term solutions, they built the community page, or Page Smith Community House, at a cost of $2 million, some huge amount of money.
Wow.
Which it provides kind of 6-month interim living space for, I think it's 40 people.
Where there used to be 100 to 200 sleeping.
Right. Who had, I mean, immediately they were camped out in tents, you know, I mean, like it was, you know, not the same kind of thing.
Right.
But they didn't replace the space that they took. They didn't set up a second campground. Instead, they, well, this is a horrible thing. It was a mud swamp. There was a shooting gallery for drugs. And they used this sort of stigmatization to avoid any kind of dealing with the solution.
Right.
Their attempt to deal with the solution, as I said, was this Proposition U, this time a family shelter program, I think largely designed to divert attention from their failure to meet any of the recommendations the homeless issues task force, which included ending the camping ban, not just the sleeping ban, but the entire camping ban, which included rent control, which included a living wage, which included significant checks on police abuse and new ways of training the police, different ways of dealing with drug emergencies so that homeless people could report them and not be afraid they were going to be dragged in, you know, as incidental to the crime there.
Right, right.
I'm sure that these are things that you have in San Francisco.
Yeah, they definitely happen here too.
Of course, the mental health issues that I've been concerned about, and they aren't unique to this area, they have your 5150, and they have unusual cozy relations between judges, mental health workers, and merchants, so that, well, particularly with judges and mental health workers. We've had a homeless activist named Chris Brozda who's being held in jail pending a conservatorship, but he wasn't being held on a 5150. He wasn't arraigned. He was held for 2 weeks. The public defender didn't try to get a writ of habeas corpus for him. And I'm getting some of these facts from his father, who may not have all the information. But the fact of the matter is, the judge kind of personally said, we'll take care of this guy and make sure he really, you know, gets the treatment he needs. Instead of, you know, doing a appropriate 5150 or an arraignment, they did some bizarre third alternative, which to me has no legal substance whatsoever. I mean,
right.
What else can you do? You either charge him with a crime or you arrest him for a psychiatric danger to self, danger to others, or
right.
Disabled, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I'm still looking into that one. Yeah, we're concerned about the Needles on Wheels program. It'll probably be rolling back our way in January when the new legislature convenes the, you know, involuntary outpatient commitment stuff that I guess is the law in 44 other states or something. I don't know if you know about that.
I've heard a little bit about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think you guys did a story on it in Street Sheet at some point.
Yeah, you know, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Group has been watching that.
Right. I'm trying to read this kind of somewhat illegible facts here.
Sorry.
Where, it's not you, it's my machine. Where else in your state are there civil rights groups, burga homeless people? Not sure what that means, but...
abuse is occurring toward homeless people, and that's mostly a question if you have other contact information that you think we don't have. Mm-hmm. You know, people are... who are homeless advocates.
Well, the main trouble with civil rights groups trying to deal with homeless issues, and I'm glad you're actually pursuing this in a systematic way, is they love to go to meetings and conferences, particularly people who are at the top of these organizations. They get funded positions, they run to meetings of the National Coalition for the Homeless or National Law Center for Homeless and Poverty Less, what it used to be Housing California, and they, you know, they have these fine little meetings, and then they go home and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the last civil rights movement we had of any substance that I was aware of was like 2.5 years ago in 1997 in Los Angeles, and it was sponsored by the Coalition on Homelessness and the LA Coalition to End Homelessness and Poverty. And as usual, it started out just fine, but then the big guns in both those offices wouldn't back it up, you know? They wouldn't pay the homeless coordinators who were supposed to be doing the work in the fields. They wouldn't organize the follow-up conventions. They wouldn't do the work that they needed to do every month. You know, they contented themselves with, it seemed to be a ploy for getting grants. It seems to be a way of getting money from large corporations or whatever corporations you get money for the kind of work you're doing, in order to do very little. You look on the National Coalition for the Homeless website, and you find nothing new over the last 9 months. Why isn't the Austin decision there? Why isn't the Portland, Oregon decision there? I don't know, go ask Michael Stoops. I can't tell you.
Right.
But I can tell you that instead we get, you know, all kinds of spiels from people that I like personally, you know, whether it's Paul or Chance about let's get some wonderful stuff done. And indeed, the coalition does good stuff. I'm glad when you guys hit the streets and do your protests as you are. And you should, and please let us know about it down here. And if we can help, we will. But it's insularity between these groups that makes it real hard to, you know, we should be sharing information all the time. There should be weekly reports between groups, whether it's all these, the street newspapers can be a very key place to use, you know, to share information and alerts and so forth, whether it's Sacramento's Homeward or Your Street Sheet or Street Spirit, or we have down here a kind of Huff Publications and the Street Shit Sheet. Santa Barbara has homeless activists, no actual, there's Nancy McCready down there, and Bob Hansen, Peter Marin are all homeless activists you can reach. Of course, there's Jennifer Wagner, Making Change in Los Angeles, and in San Diego there is Forrest and Ann Curo of Streetlight, fine newspaper they've been struggling to put out every month, which you probably have read.
Yeah, Streetlight.
Yeah, Streetlight.
Streetlight.
Like L-I-G-H-T.
I've seen that.
Oh yeah, it's great paper. And, you know, it's, I think that there are also activists up north, Ruben Batillo, Batillo of the, he does a homeless internet news service, but he's considered too radical for, you know, I don't know, the bosses, so to speak, what is it, Berkeley Outreach Support Services, is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big cheeses who've been sitting on top of the homeless pie for two decades, and they make their living off of it, and I'm sure they're well-intentioned, but, you know, they aren't really going anywhere with their, what they're doing. I mean, they're struggling against cuts from the Republicans, and they want to, you know, little bits of the pie instead of meaningful, significant, broad-based change at the bottom. And I'm always cranky about that, and I'm not afraid to talk about it.
Well, that's clear.
Right. And no doubt it'll get me in trouble because there's also a positive side to what folks do. I mean, there are many, many good things that even people at the top do, but you got to consider, of all the resources people have, you know, are they being used? And
right, and it doesn't make sense to do something if you can't look at it critically, because nothing is ever exactly right the first time, or usually most of the time, so.
Right, I mean, I just, when I heard about your project, I thought, oh, here we go again, you know. We get to see another round. I mean, it sounds like it. I like these questions, and I'd love to see them effectively answered at a national level. I think it's going to be quite a positive thing. But as a part of the national, this comes out of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Is that right? Or
yeah. I mean, it was done by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty before. And
right, this is a group that, you know, for love or money, can't get you a report unless you forward them $50 or something. I mean, you know,
right.
The homeless groups are going to have that kind of money. I mean, come on. And they should have a fund set aside to give this kinds of, you know, reports to. Every homeless newspaper in the country should get a copy of this report.
Yeah.
But do they, you know, do they say, I don't know what their financial problems are. I just know the kind of the voice tone I get when I talk to these people on the phone, you know. Now, I have gotten some help from Maria Foscanaris, I'm not sure what her name is. And,
yeah, Foscanaris.
And the other folks there, and, you know, and I, my hat's off to them for that. It's just real hard to get people. One feels like one's breaking through. often it's more difficult, I think, than it should be. And it's also true even with the coalition. I mean, you know, you have a situation where, dare I say, an inside clique often operates where people are, you know, if they don't like you, forget it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's not entirely true. I mean, I'm. The coalition's been very helpful in getting these street sheets every month, and we do share information, and I'm glad that we're both doing what we're doing. I wish it were easier for all of us. I don't know what the answer is. Perhaps, you know, you're working on one of those answers now. I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure, but I think you have some valid points.
Yeah. I know everything, man.
Well, that is good to know. I'll call you more often.
Yeah, man.
If I had known that earlier.
Right, of course. You really have to talk to my secretary, and I can't see, and I'm awfully busy. Right.
Right, well, I'll leave 10 messages, and then hopefully.
Right, I'll get my secretary. We'll talk to your secretary.
Sounds good.
Hey, listen, thank you very much. And we've been talking to
Elisa Delapiana.
And Elisa, you're a legal worker, or you're an aspiring attorney, or you're a flunk?
I'm currently a law student. And I don't know if aspiring attorney is the most complimentary thing that anyone could say about me, but
definitely
that's
not.
Probably true.
How do you get an attorney out of a tree?
How?
Cut the rope. The other thing is, you might want to look into San Jose. You've probably seen how locally and recently, and I was part of this protest, this sit-ins at city council in San Jose to make them deal with their sleeping bans and their failure to provide adequate appropriations to deal with the homeless crisis there. has their, I guess the first bunch of people went to trial, and they were all found guilty of disrupting a public meeting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was about a week and a half ago, and my group goes to trial in a week and a half. There's a total of 23 people, I think.
Wow.
And I guess that we may plead out, because everybody else but me apparently wants to plead out, and I may just say, hey, why not, you know what I mean?
Right.
The question of whether I was disrupting a public meeting. Me disrupt a public meeting?
I can't imagine.
Hey, man. But there are people there you might call Scott Wagers, and the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry is a good contact point. San Jose is, what, it's the second largest city in the state or something? It's a...
Yeah, I know that Mara has been talking to Scott Wagers, so...
That's good.
I think we do have some information on what's going on there.
All right, well...
Thank you so much.
And thank you for being on Free Radio Santa Cruz and allowing me an opportunity to endlessly talk.
Well, it was very informative. I may call you with some follow-up questions, but the information you have given me is wonderful.
And you will give me a report without a $50 charge?
You will certainly get a report, and there will be no charge.
Whoa. Well, now we're talking.
And if it's all right with you, I'd like to have you look over the write-up for Santa Cruz before it even makes it into the report.
Okay, whatever you do, don't criticize me, because I'm very sensitive.
No problem.
Okay, sounds good, and thank you for, you know, for doing this. I'd love to hear, you know, some of the more obscure areas of the state, like northeastern California, which nobody ever, I don't even know the names of any of the cities up there.
Right.
Or southeastern California. Who knows what's happening to homeless people there? We'd love to get some contacts in those cities.
Well, we should try to expand when we have a second go at it.
There you go. Send out somebody on a junket to the Mojave Desert.
are you going to volunteer for that job?
I will be in touch by telephone at any time.
Okay. Sounds good.
Hey, good to hear you.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
Thank you, Elise.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Talking to attorney James Fossbinder, and also I should say activist James Fossbinder, on the phone in Los Angeles. Hey, James.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Now, last time I saw you, you were parading around the Shadow Convention headquarters in Los Angeles, ducking the massive lines of police. You've gotten a number of cases that have come out of the convention, and also there's a Rampart scandal. Any updates for us on what's going on in L.A. at the moment?
As we can tell, at this point, the city is sort of in a duck-and-cover mode. They have so much litigation that's come out of both the Democratic National Convention and the Rampart scandal that they're refusing to even talk about settlement cases that we have, which are essentially identical to cases in the past that they would have been very eager to settle. It's a funny thing, because it's going to end up almost certainly costing them a lot more money in the long run, but it may be sort of like the Drudgeford Sports website on election night. They may just be so overwhelmed that they just can't do anything.
Now, you've taken the cases of many relatively famous activists. I ran into you with Ben Mizell down in L.A., and you just secured for him a settlement? Or did he get that through another attorney? I'm not sure what the...
Well, I think he had just gotten a settlement out of Chicago, maybe coming out of the last convention. He's certainly been involved in litigation for many years. Ben was one of my very first clients in 1984 at the Republican National Convention in Dallas. Ben and some others had arranged to have the dead Kennedys play outside the convention center as the delegates arrived. And oddly enough, the city of Dallas did not want the dead Kennedys playing outside the convention center as the delegates arrived. So that was actually my first case as a lawyer, was I represented Ben and some others.
Well, maybe it was a case of truth in advertising. They wanted the real dead Kennedys.
Well, those who say they were helped to be responsible to that, but I'm not saying that's true. But they certainly didn't want the other dead Kennedys, Bella Biafra, down there serenading the busloads of delegates as they arrived. But it turned out they had no law at all that regulated it, and federal judge, whose name was Barefoot Saunders, told him, well, you don't have a law that says they can't do it. I guess they can do it.
And did you get permission for them to proceed, or did you get some settlement afterward?
No, the judge made it perfectly clear to the city they could either tell him that they wouldn't interfere with the dead Kennedy concert outside the convention site in 1984, or he would order an injunction. And they backed down and assured the judge that they would not interfere in any way with the dead Kennedy's concert, and they didn't, actually.
you've been to numerous presidential conventions over the last couple decades. Have you? How would you describe this one that happened in Los Angeles recently in comparison? Or did it seem to you notably more repressive than previous ones? What's your take on that?
Particularly sort of oppressive just in the nature of the spot. It's sort of like a no city area in the city. It's completely surrounded by almost science fiction looking level of freeway interchanges and overpasses, and it's really a very desolate place. But actually, it's pretty similar to the Chicago Convention Center and to the Convention Center in Dallas. Is not exactly a parkland either, so I mean, that's where convention centers tend to get built, but did create a rather kind of Blade Runner-esque situation, I thought.
Yeah, how about the way people were treated? Any sense of anything stick in your mind about this last convention?
It seems as though the pattern that's arising in how cities deal with this type of event is that they basically just figure, we're going to violate a whole bunch of people's rights. We don't really care. It's going to cost some money, but compared to the amount of money we make bringing the convention in, it's a drop in the bucket. And one of the problems that has been going on in Los Angeles for many years is that the city council has always backed up police officers who were sued, even where the police officers had punitive damage awards against them, which means that the citizens who sat on the jury said, hey, this police officer acted absolutely outrageously, way beyond the law. We're absolutely sure about it. We're going to award punitive damages. The city council has gone ahead and, out of city funds, paid those punitive damages. And what that creates is a situation where the police officers and the bureaucrats in charge of giving out permits really don't give a shit because it's not out of their pocket. We're facing that exact same situation. In fact, there was litigation over the use of Pershing Square Park in Los Angeles, which resulted in an order from a federal judge saying that all of the Parks Department regulations concerning getting a permit to do a First Amendment-protected event were struck down, and he ordered them not to enforce it. Well, we have a client who's now suing the city of Los Angeles. This will be his fourth suit. So far, he's won two, and one is still pending. Harry Perry, he's famous as the roller skating urban Sikh guitarist who ran the L.A. Marathon in about 3 hours recently. He's in his 50s. So he's an interesting guy, and he's worked very hard to try to open the parks up to free public rock and roll shows with a free speech motive or reason behind them, and it's just been a nightmare, and we keep winning, and they just keep not caring. And to show just how outrageous it is, despite this order that said that they could not enforce any of their existing regulations, 3 weeks after the convention, after telling the city attorney's office that he was going to go and try and get a permit from the Parks Department, Griffith Park, they followed the same old regulations that they had been for years and ignored the judge's order, which said that the regulations were struck down and that all they could do was ask for your name, approximately how many people were going to show up, where you wanted to use it, and they had to give you the permit 3 days without any money. Well, they ignored all that. They gave him a form and said he was going to have to come up with $1,000, that they were going to have discretionary control over the, when to shut it down, and on and on and on, despite the fact that the city attorney's office knew that that he was coming down to do it. So they really are just, completely contemptuous of the whole legal process.
What was his response? Did he proceed to hold the event anyway?
Well, scheduled for November 19th, and interestingly enough, he just got a phone call today. We just served the officer who is in charge of dealing with permits at Griffith Park yesterday with a subpoena for her deposition, and today she called up Harry Perry and said, oh, well, I got a subpoena, and I'm going to give you your permit, so I'll mail it out right away tomorrow. So it really isn't until they're actually on their way into court that all of a sudden they remember that maybe the Constitution has something to do with all this, and maybe we can't just do whatever we feel like. But traditionally, that's what they've done in L.A., is they've just done whatever they felt like.
It was kind of hard during the convention to see homeless people in the area where the convention was being held, or even in the parks. I know that, of course, a homeless protest was shot down, including the leader, Ted Hayes, not with lead bullets or with rubber bullets, on the Monday evening protest. But what? Any comments on the interaction between the police and the homeless in Los Angeles, particularly as relating to the Democratic National Convention and the Ramparts scandal? I mean, I know that the Martha Mitchell case has been sort of simmering for a year, where this woman was, shot, I'm not sure how many times, shot dead for allegedly wielding a knife as she walked away with her shopping cart or something. Do you recall that case?
I'm aware of the case. I'm not involved in the case in any way. The interesting thing in Los Angeles, and I think this is probably true in a number of the bigger cities, is that they sort of schlepped the homeless around from one part of town to another. For a while, they were encouraged to go out to the Venice Beach area. Then they kind of tried to densify that a little. Then they picked this incredibly desolate part of downtown and have encouraged them to go there. Then it turned out that the convention was coming, and they decided maybe they didn't want any homeless people down there then. So they just kind of move them around. It's difficult. The courts are giving the police tremendous leeway and the ability to prosecute, public intoxication, all these minor crimes that put them in jail for a few days and give them the message to go somewhere else. It's certainly a problem that needs addressing, but frankly, it's not one that we've had much to do with.
Yesterday's LA Times talks about even the city attorney saying that there are going to be massive number of cases that cannot be prosecuted because the attempt to show where police officers maybe have a record of improper behavior, so-called pitchess motions, is now suspect, that there's no way to get that kind of information. I was struck by this because the city attorney is part of the prosecuting team in a way, right, in Los Angeles.
Well, it's interesting. Joe Garcetti, who was, the man in terms of law enforcement in Los Angeles, just lost, if I read the LA Times correctly, by 2-1 after being a winner repeatedly with wide margins. So I think the citizens of the city realize that there's a very real problem with the district attorney, and they hopefully have solved it. But we'll see what happens in the future.
What about this case, what about the U.S.'s intervention, the courts, I guess, and is the Department of Justice intervening locally to require oversight of the police department? Do you see this as being a token move, a real move, something between the two?
I don't think the evidence is there to show what it is yet. It's an interesting thing. In the past, I've had cases where I thought that there was clear-cut evidence of corruption against county officials, and we've contacted the FBI, and they basically said, well, if you can set up a sting where you can show us where to put the video camera and, you do all the work and we'll do something about it. I think there's a tendency, obviously, at a time of a convention for the government to try to look like they're doing things right. And I think that, a fair amount of it's for show and some of it's for real, but time will give us a little better evidence on that. I really don't want to be too cynical about it, but I'm highly skeptical that they really intend to do anything.
Any other comments on events coming out of the Democratic National Convention or the current Ramparts court struggle or administrative city council struggle that you think will have impacts elsewhere in California and across the country regarding how police...
There are two general comments I think I'd like to make. One is that Southern California, both San Diego and Los Angeles, adopted a paramilitary model of policing, which really had some remarkable cost savings, but in terms of dollars, but the cost, I think, was borne in civil rights violations upon the citizens. Both Los Angeles and San Diego County have a record of having relatively few police per capita, vastly lower numbers of police per capita than, say, New York or Philadelphia. But they've also gotten away with murder. San Diego, several years ago, had the highest rate of police shootings of citizens of any major city in the country. Now, they've kind of cleaned their act up down there, and the police shooting rate is way down. Los Angeles hasn't had such a bad rate of shootings, but they've really had a pattern of systematically violating people's constitutional rights. And so, of course, they don't care. I mean, it's very... difficult to get any sort of system-wide intervention on the part of judges in Los Angeles, San Diego, to really get into these matters. It's not impossible to win individual cases that show that the police have violated the clients' rights. It's just hard to get the judges to recognize that there's a real pattern there, despite the fact it's been very obvious. Rampart's was something that's been brewing for decades. I mean, everybody who was involved in the police brutality litigation area knew that there were outrageous things going on in downtown L.A., and many complaints were filed, and many people made protests about this, and it wasn't until a police officer confessed that all of a sudden it became real.
Mm-hmm. And you had a second point you thought should be made?
That really what we have to do is to, if we want to have a country where we have justice for all, we have to, or even something that vaguely approaches that, we have to look really carefully at the war on drugs, because the reality is that almost all of the resources in the so-called justice system are being soaked up by dealing with the drug problem, and perhaps the initiative that was just passed,
Proposition 36,
California.
Right. What do you think will be the impact of Proposition 36 in Los Angeles?
Well, it's going to have a huge impact. I recently defended a woman who had a very serious drug problem. She was a teenager when she became addicted to crack. Her mother tried to help her out. Her family tried to help her out, and she just had a severe addiction to crack. She was not a dealer. She was nonviolent, and the only response that the city of Los Angeles had was they wanted to put her in jail. They wanted to put her in jail. And they put her in jail, and it just didn't do anything. She just went back on the street and got arrested again because she was an addict. And there's just no point to jailing these people.
And we've been talking to James Fassbinder. James is an attorney activist in Los Angeles who will be taking the lawsuit against the LAPD being filed by activist Becky Johnson, who was beaten by police at the Democratic National Coronation or Convention, depending on how you want to describe it. More updates on this. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Thank you for being with us. This has been a special pre-recorded tape. Tune in to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides every Thursday from 6 to 8 in the evening, every Sunday from 11.